you're listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, it's been one of the surprise movie successes of 2024. The Bob Marley biopic One Love is reviving interest in the man and the music more than 40 years after his death. Now, Canada and Toronto specifically had a hand to play in Marley's early international success. Marley loved the city, finding a vibrant Jamaican community there that was already bringing reggae to the city back in the 60s and 70s. We learn more about Marley and the history of reggae in Canada and how those two came together in the mid to late 70s. This week marks a decade since one of the great mysteries in modern aviation began to unfold. Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 vanished with 227 passengers and 12 crew on board. What happened? Why hasn't more of the wreckage been found? Will there ever be a new search? We find out. But first, a big blow today to Montreal and to the Canadian and international comedy world. The long-running and renowned Summer Just for Laughs Festival announced today that it will not be held in 2024, and the organization behind it is filing for bankruptcy protection. There is hope a restructuring will allow the festival to return in 2025. Montreal comedian Joey Elias is with me to talk about his early memories of Just for Laughs, his 17 appearances at the festival over the many years, and what that exposure has meant for comedians from right across the country, and what chance he thinks there is for the festival to make a comeback.
Montreal's own Joey Elias.
Nice to be here. Nice to be back in Montreal. Home sweet home. Yeah. Every time I come back, though, I forget that I don't speak French. Yeah. You think I'd remember. You know, I know enough to get by. Like, I know we, no, well, because I vote.
All right, I grew up in Montreal, so that one's an easy one to get. But Montreal comedian Joey Elias is in one of his 17 appearances at the famed International Comedy Festival that started and grew in his very own backyard, so to speak. Not quite, it was downtown, but nonetheless. And so he was one of many today left to wonder what's next after the Just for Laughs or Juste pour Rire or organizers announced that they are seeking creditor protection under Canada's Bankruptcy and Insolvency Act, and that the 2024 edition of the long-running festival, it's been going on since 1983, has been canceled. They said, unfortunately, the 2024 edition of the Just for Laughs, Juste pour Rire Festival will not take place, at least not at the same time and in the same form as it customarily has. The company said in a news release today, once restructuring is complete, we hope that the festival will take place in 2025. They're also looking for investors to sell part of the business. Now, as I mentioned, this festival began to take shape 40 years ago. All the way back in 1983, I remember being down on Saint-Denis in the eastern part of downtown Montreal when it first started to burgeon. Then by 1985, someone named Andy Nullman came in, a gentleman quite well known in Montreal and around the world, actually in comedy circles, came in and started an English side of it. And it just took off. And all of a sudden, Montreal became kind of a festival city in the summer. There was the film festival, of course, back then, which we no longer really have, but there was also the Jazz Fest and the Comedy Fest and the Grand Prix. And all together, they made for this incredible string of events that stretched right across what is often a too short a summer in Montreal. So by 1985, Jay Leno had been in town over the years. I mean, it's a who's who of comedians who would turn up for this. Louis Anderson, Steve Wright, Lily Tomlin, Rowan Atkinson, Jerry Seinfeld, Bob Newhart, Jim Carrey, Dave Chappelle, Adam Sandler, even George Burns, Roy Romano, Kevin James, Jon Stewart, Amy Schumer, Sugar Sammy, Steve Martin, Ali Wong, and someone who we paid tribute to last night because it was 30 years since John Candy passed away.
You know, there's all kinds of laughs. You know, there's the chuckle. And then there's the belly laugh, which we just had here. And then, of course, there's the network executive laugh.
John Candy. He hosted that gala. I think that was back to sometime in the very early 90s there. Joey Elias, of course, as I mentioned earlier, has been around, has performed at about half of the English versions of Just for Laughs or the Juste pour Rire Just for Laughs Festival since it first premiered back in 1985, including four televised gala performances. You may have seen him in movies such as The Art of War and The Day After Tomorrow. And he joins me now from Montreal. Joey, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Oh, my pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, man, I was just thinking back to the early days, and it felt like Just for Laughs was the festival that would never change, that it was just, there was so much momentum behind it, that it would always be with us. And I was shocked. I mean, I'm not in Quebec right now, but I was shocked to wake up this morning and read that news.
Yeah, it was a gut punch, you know, to wake up to that. And, you know, you turn on your phone and your phone just explodes. And that's what happened this morning. And, you know, you think, oh, God, what happened? And that was not anything that I was expecting, you know, from somebody who's performed and worked for them from the outside. Everything looked like it was doing great. I know that they just completed their festival, you know, Just for Laughs West in Vancouver. From all information, that went really well and successful. So, you know, it was very shocking. And, you know, and then as the day progressed, you just think back, like listening to your intro, like you brought back St. Denis Street. And I was just sitting here nodding, you know, because that's what it was for me. I remember going as a 15-year-old, you know, with my cousin who got tickets to see Stephen Wright.
Right.
And I had already been a comedy fan. But to be in, you know, in the middle of, you know, the street performers and, the, you know, it was just like this crazy. It was like you were in your own bubble. Nobody, the outside world didn't matter. As soon as you got onto St. Denis Street, everything, you know, from work to family to politics, it disappeared. And you were in this magical world of comedy and laughter. And that's a huge void that the city of Montreal is going to have this summer.
Yeah. And just its impact on comedy, not just for Montreal, of which you, of course, you know, obviously it influenced you, but for Canadian comedy, period, to have these stars coming in and just the way it influenced and launched the careers of just about every, you know, Russell Peters, anybody you can think of, came through that festival at one point in time.
Yeah, you know, when I started, I guess it was a different beast, but, you know, as Canadian comedians, that was what we aimed for. Because it was this juggernaut of a festival. I mean, there were other festivals, but everybody from everywhere was coming here to perform. They wanted to perform in Montreal. Agents came, you know, deals were signed here. And so to be a part of that and to see how that grew, and, you know, back in the day it was, if you got Just for Laughs, it was really a notch on your belt. And I'm not saying that it isn't today, but again, that was the only thing comedians had to look up to. And being a Montreal performer, it meant even more for me. And I can honestly say that, you know, without Just for Laughs and, you know, being part of that and being chosen to be part of the festivals numerous times, without that, I'm not, you know, you're talking to somebody else and not me. It's very simple. Just for Laughs is that important to comedians of my generation and even, you know, the younger generation. And that was also a thought I had today, was I feel so bad for some of these younger comics that have already put forth and they had auditions for the festival this summer in Montreal. So, you know, we do know that the ones in Toronto and Vancouver are going to continue. So hopefully that the people that auditioned for that will be considered for those. Because I can't imagine having to put in so much work and effort into honing, you know, a festival set, something that you look up to and look forward to. And then all of a sudden, you know, the rug is pulled out from underneath you. It must be disappointing and disheartening, but, you know, there is a belief, as you said, that they're going to restructure and come back next summer. And, you know, my fingers are crossed that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I remember growing up as a Montreal Anglo. The other thing Just for Laughs was really quite amazing at is it exposed me to a lot of French comedy too, which there was always a bit of, you know, there was a bit of two solitudes when it came to the arts in Montreal, whether it was music and so on, but certainly in comedy. And the Just for Laughs Festival, I think, exposed a lot of people to young French speaking comedians as well, which was part of its beauty in some ways, especially since it started at a time when those relations, you know, we were heading into the 95 referendum, things were a little fraught back then. You know, we've just been talking about Brian Mulroney, and so on. The national issue was huge. And it felt like, as you mentioned earlier, that sort of disappeared on St. Denis, that's in those summer months in July.
Yeah, you know, the one thing that brought everybody together in this city, English and French, other than, you know, the dislike for the Maple Leafs, was humor. And, you know, whether it was a French performer that did, you know, was successful, perfect example, André-Philippe Gagnon. Nobody on the English side knew him when he broke, you know, at Just for Laughs. Jay Leno discovered him from there, and then he ends up, you know, being on The Tonight Show. So all of a sudden, we were, like you said, it opened up our eyes as, you know, Canadians, but also it gave the French Canadians exposure to American agents who said, listen, this guy's talented. I don't care that I don't really understand what he's saying. They're talented. And that's what's going to lack as well. Is, you know, some of, you know, for some of the people that end up on the new faces of comedy show, there's one segment that's for the unrepresented, you know, unrepresented comic. So if they're looking for representation, that's the show where they showcase for representation. So again, it's, you know, having spoken to a few comics that don't live in Montreal, but would always come in for the fest, you know, one of the things they said is like, now what's my excuse to go have, you know, greasy food and drink excessively and have fun? And I was like, well, you can come over, but it won't be the same, that's for sure. And if anybody who's listening right now has been to Montreal, lives in Montreal, or has been following Montreal politics, I feel bad for the vendors, you know, downtown, restaurants, the little cafes, everything in and around, you know, the festival, they're going to suffer.
Yeah.
But the good news is, the good news is that there are comedy clubs in Montreal, and hopefully people in the city will still be like, you know what? There is a void. There's no big, huge festival shows at theaters, but I'm going to go to my local comedy club. I'm going to go to the Comedy Nest. I'm going to support the local people. And I think that's kind of a benefit. Is that maybe, you know, the local scene grows a little bit.
Had you noticed at all, just from the work that you're doing, that there could be problems with the structure of Just for Laughs, the way it was built, the way that its revenue streams worked? I mean, it's expensive to put on those big festivals now. We've seen it with music festivals all over the place. And I suppose with Just for Laughs, I mean, it really came down to a question of finances, right? I mean, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't even pretend to know, even if the books were in front of me, what to look for,
right.
You know, but you know, what they stated in the press release was sponsorship. And you look at some of the posters from, you know, pre-COVID from the Just for Laughs festival, and you see all the sponsors that were there. And then you look at, you know, a festival poster from last summer, and you realize some of those, you know, companies can no longer afford to sponsor anything. Some of them, you know, it would look very poor for somebody who just got, you know, $1 billion buyout from the government to all of a sudden throw sponsorship money into a festival. I don't think that's where the bailout money is supposed to go to. So once you start losing sponsorship like that, it's hard to make up that lost revenue, I would imagine. So, you know, like they said, you know, when they do restructure, it's going to be a scaled back version of what we grew up, you know. I always thought that, like you said, again, I'm just stuck on the Saint Denis thing, just being, you know, a 12-year-old kid. That was the first time my parents took me down on a Sunday afternoon because it was the parade of twins. Do you remember
right,
that?
I remember
everybody
that.
Who was
I
a
do.
Twin.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like kind of creepy.
It was more accessible than the Jazz Fest if you were a kid, right? There was just something about it.
Yeah, I mean they had, like I said, it was they had set up like a whole area for kids to, you know, like a jungle gym, but they were part of the fest. And I even remember bringing my nephew down to Saint Denis, you know, when he was like 4 or 5, and there was all these things where, you know, the kids can get their face painted and they were human chess pieces and people were doing magic on the street. And it was fantastic. It was just, that's the buzz that I think the city is going to miss big time. And like you said, it starts with the Grand Prix and then it goes into Jazz Fest and then you would have Just for Laughs.
Yeah.
So what happens in those 2 weeks? I don't really know.
Montreal comedian Joey Elias is with us this half hour. We're talking about big news today, not just for Montreal, but for the Canadian comedy community, for the international comedy community. The Just for Laughs Festival, perhaps one of Montreal's most, certainly one of Montreal's most famous summer festivals that usually runs in July, is not going to happen, at least not the way we've always known it, in 2024. The company behind it, the organization behind it, has filed for bankruptcy protection or is about to. So this year, because of a number of reasons, sponsorship, the pandemic, and so on and so forth, inflation, it's just not going to happen. And it's a huge loss for Montreal specifically, but also for the comedy world in general. We've been talking about all the many, many stars who've graced the stages and the different shows and different galas at Just for Laughs and Just Pour Rire over the years. Kevin James was introducing you in that clip I played off the top. Joey, you must have met some, I mean, you are as well, but you must have met some titans over the years.
Yeah, that was the whole, you know, experience too of still being, you know, a huge comedy fan while I was being allowed into this inner sanctum. I tried very hard not to fanboy when I met a young Dave Chappelle. Getting given experience and advice by Billy Connolly as we crossed the street together after his show. It was just these very surreal moments of like, this would only happen in Montreal at this festival. Like I said, there was a magic about the whole environment, and everybody in the city was in a good mood. Everybody who came to the city was in a good mood. Nobody really cared about not finding parking 20 minutes before the show. By the time they left the show, everybody was in a good mood. And boy, I'll tell you, this city definitely needs a lot of laughter now. So hopefully, like I said, you know, people that were going to go spend the amount of money they were going to spend on those tickets, hopefully they do go to the local comedy clubs. And even if they, you know, in whatever town anybody's listening in, you know, there's so much great talent across this country and there's great clubs in every city. Just think about, you know, you can go see performers that you've seen on television on Just for Laughs for like $20. That's a crazy price. That's less than a movie nowadays. So that's what I hope comes out of this, is that there's kind of like a very nice support of Canadian comics, especially the young ones that are going to miss out on a potential, you know, summer of getting exposed to the world. So that's what I hope, is that everybody ventures out to their local comedy club.
Yeah, and I hope just there's enough admiration and appreciation for the Just for Laughs, Just Pour Rire Festival that somehow it comes back. I mean, I was reading the other day that they're pouring more money into the Olympic Stadium, and I thought, well, that's empty. So why not pour it into downtown and try and make this come alive again? Because it has really been, there's a big hole in the middle of that festival schedule now. But I mean, fingers crossed. I know it's a bit gloomy today because we're just hearing the news, but one would expect that it has enough of sort of an international rep that it might come back and we might be able to see some of that magic again.
Oh, I'm definitely hopeful. You know, seeing some of the Franco comics talk about there's a big festival overseas that, you know, really focuses in on French speaking comedians. They may get involved on the Just Pour Rire side. And I should mention that the French side took a much bigger hit today than the English side. As much as it sucks for English comics, the French comics today took a massive hit because year round they tour, you know, the up and coming and the big name artists across the province, and then they take them overseas to, you know, France and Belgium. So today they canceled 6 shows right out of the gate, and that's, you know, performers and their producers and everybody behind the scenes and theaters. So, you know, even though they said only 70 people lost their job, there's a lot more jobs that were lost too. So I think about the economics of, you know, what it does to the city. And like you brought up, there's a giant hole in the city, and that's like our downtown core right now, resembles Detroit in the late 80s. Nobody's down there. So it's a lot of vagrants. It's a lot of homelessness right now, a lot of construction. So after sundown, there's not much going on It's not like what downtown, like we, you and I remember. So that's why the festival was so key in bringing people back downtown.
Well, hopefully people with money and people in power recognize the value of it. Joey, have a steamy for me. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. And thanks for inviting me on, and hope to talk to you under better circumstance next time.
Malaysian 370, contact Ho Chi Minh 120.9. Good night.
Good night, Malaysian 370.
Those were the words, the first ones, of 53-year-old Captain Zahari Ahmed Shah. The last communication between MH Flight 370 and the control tower in Kuala Lumpur. And what would unfold in the moments after that is perhaps the greatest mystery in aviation history. The Boeing 777 was making a routine 5.5-hour flight from the Malaysian capital to Beijing in China, a trip that I've made on the exact same route on the same airline in the past, when it vanished with 227 passengers, including two Canadians and 12 crew on board. Someone turned off the transponder after that communication with the tower in Kuala Lumpur. It was supposed to be handed over, as was mentioned there, to Ho Chi Minh, Vietnam. Instead of continuing on its route to Beijing, it turned and went completely off course after that final contact, flew back across Malaysia, headed north ever so briefly in the Strait of Malacca before turning south and traveling for hours, it's believed, until it ran out of fuel and crashed into a remote part of the southern Indian Ocean. 10 years later, we still know little more than we did in the months following the disappearance. Some debris is washed up far away from the presumed crash site on Reunion Island and in Mozambique, but extensive searches, perhaps the largest in history, were carried out in the months and years that followed the disappearance of MH370, and the wreckage has yet to be found. Despite numerous theories, and there are many theories out there, there have been dozens of books written about this. As you know, nature abhors a vacuum and loves a conspiracy. But the most plausible explanation remains, according to aviation investigators, that the pilot, 53-year-old Captain Zahari Ahmed Shah, took the plane off course intentionally and guided it towards its tragic end. Now, there have been no new official searches since 2018, when the last one by a private company wrapped up. But the families of the missing and presumed dead still hold out hope that the wreckage will be found.
They owe it to the world. They owe it to the family members to find out what happened.
There is a Texas-based company that claims to have scientific evidence of MH370's final resting place at the bottom of the ocean. They've already conducted one of those searches I was mentioning back that ended in 2018. And they're proposing a new search, a proposal the Malaysian government says it is open to considering.
They are ready and they have finalized the proposal, and we are ready to discuss the proposal. No reluctance. As I've mentioned numerous times, as far as Malaysian government is concerned, we are committed to that search, and the search must go on.
Indeed, but they have qualified that, saying what they want to see is credible evidence that the search must be continued. In this case, the company, Infinity Ocean, I believe it's called, has already said that they would do this and only be paid if they were to locate it. So there is some hope that there will be a new search sometime soon. But for the time being, all that's really left is to analyze the data that's already there and try and figure out the answer to some of the mysteries that remain 10 years later. Joining me now is John Cox. He's an aviation safety professional, CEO of Safety Operating Systems. He's a retired airline pilot himself and a longtime aircraft accident investigator who's looked into this case many times, when asked to comment on it many times over the years. John, thanks for your time. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me. Good to see you.
This one, you know, I mean, I think back to when it happened 10 years ago, and I was a reporter working as a foreign correspondent, so it's something that we covered. And I think right off the bat was this idea that, you know, Boeing 777s don't just vanish into thin air.
No, they don't. And that was what was the big surprise at the beginning of this. I mean, all of us felt like, well, we'd be able to find it pretty quickly because we knew where it was. And then to realize that we didn't know where it was, and that the airplane had traveled thousands of miles on a course that was unexpected, that was pretty shocking to all of us.
Yeah, I mean, maybe if we can go back through a bit of the timeline, because I mean, I've actually been on a Malaysian Airlines flight between Beijing and Kuala Lumpur back when I was based there. It is a pretty straightforward flight, about 5.5 hours, doesn't go over any particularly dangerous periods. The weather is pretty good in that part of the world. It felt like a very routine flight.
Yep. I mean, it's flown multiple times a day and has been for years. There was in the early stages, there was nothing non-routine or unusual about the flight.
What then? I mean, we understand now with the benefits. I mean, this all came out in dribs and drabs over the following months. But just as this flight is on its prepared course and it's heading into Vietnamese airspace, it all of a sudden starts to do stuff that will always be, I suppose, at this point in time, remain the mystery.
To a point, I mean, I think we can come up with several deductions. One, the airplane flew a specific path that had to be commanded for it to do that. It's not something the airplane itself could generate. So someone commanded it to fly that path. Coincidentally, it was right along where two airspaces contact each other. It's called a flight information region or FIR. And it flies right down the FIR, then it turns at an island, it goes right down another FIR, and then goes offshore to just where the ground radar would no longer be able to see it, and then it turns south. That's not random. So we know that someone had to tell the airplane to do that. There's been people that allege fire. There's never been an aircraft with a major fire on board that flew that long. Also, if you have a fire, the pilots tend to say that they have a fire on board, and they want to divert to a nearby airport. None of that happened. So now you have to begin to look at more sinister possibilities, and sadly, that's where the evidence points.
Right. And a transponder turned off. I mean, essentially, it made itself, whomever was presumably flying the plane, or somebody else for that matter, because we just don't know. But the transponders turned off. I mean, there are attempts by this plane, whomever's flying it, apparently, or presumably, to cloak it.
Absolutely. And that's yet another piece of evidence. The transponder, what we know definitively is it ceased to have power. Now, whether that was due to a switch being put into standby or whether it was a deprivation of electrical power, that's open to speculation. But we know that and this all occurred at the same time, yet the airplane still continued to transmit via the ACARS system that it had electrical power. So all of these incremental and small circumstantial pieces line up in one direction.
So, I mean, we have many things that have happened, and as a longtime aircraft crash investigator, what are some of the things that stood out to you early? Because I'm trying to think back to 10 years ago, and it took a while for the Malaysian military to admit that they had been tracking the plane as it turned and diverted or went in a different direction. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on that felt like it kind of hampered, or at least as you pointed out earlier, because of the way that the route that the plane took, there were a lot of elements in place that made for the fact that investigators got a bit of a late start on this one.
They did. Some of it was none of the military was initially very cooperative in saying what they knew for the simple reason is they didn't do anything about it. This airplane flew along this FIR boundary for quite a long time, and no one in the military called. No one said, "Who is this?" No one, they didn't do very much. So I think there was a bit of embarrassment about that, both with the Vietnamese and the Malaysian controllers. So, when you really look at it, not providing that information early on to the investigators hampered it to some degree, but it did come out, and it came out within a few days.
Right. And then a little bit later, as we're trying to figure out where this plane could have actually gone, then we start to get the satellite data from Inmarsat. But I gather one of the big challenges with this is that while we got it was one satellite. So normally satellites rely on a certain triangulation to give you a specific location. In this case, we simply didn't have that. I mean, you end up with this with a wide area where this plane could have presumably gone down.
It's true. The Inmarsat data, when they first got it and they're looking at it, because of the way the arc works. It was an area of thousands upon thousands of miles. And someone within Inmarsat said, you know, I think we can do better with this data. And they went to a very innovative approach, never been done before. And they started utilizing a thing called Doppler shift. And that allowed them to improve the quality of the calculations. And now instead of thousands upon thousands upon thousands of square miles, they were able to narrow it down. But the question was, how good was the math? And they did a very smart thing. They got a lot of experts, world experts, to look at the math, to look at the calculations. And it all came back that they were right, that they were valid. And so that gave us a lot more confidence in the Inmarsat data and where they were saying to look for it. When you look now at the conspiracy theorists and the people who come out and say, oh, I know where the Malaysia 370 is, yet none of them have provided their data and their level of peer review, professional review, that Inmarsat did. So I'm confident in the Inmarsat data. I talked to some folks that I know that are very, very bright mathematicians. And I asked them point blank. I said, how good is the Inmarsat data? And they said, you can trust it. And I have no reason not to. So I think that Inmarsat did a remarkable job. I think they're to be complimented about the innovative way that they assisted in the investigation.
It is therefore with deep sadness and regret that I must inform you that according to this new data, flight MH370 ended in the southern Indian Ocean.
John Cox is with us this half hour, aviation safety professional, CEO of Safety Operating Systems. He's an airline, retired airline pilot himself, and a longtime aircraft accident investigator. So, John, we have an idea. It's a very large space, I think, even compared to the search area in the Atlantic for that Air France flight that went down after leaving Rio. It was considerably larger than that at the time. But we launched this massive operation to try to find the remnants of MH370. But it's in an incredibly difficult area to search. And it's a really tall order. From that point on, solving this mystery becomes infinitely more difficult.
It definitely does. The geography of the ocean floor in this area, it's very mountainous. It's also an area that is so remote, it has not been mapped extensively. There's not a lot of ship traffic there. There's not a lot of aviation traffic there. It is one of the most remote parts of our world. So the challenge that the searchers were facing was daunting in that they have a generalized area that's tens of thousands of feet deep. And then on top of it, you have mountains that can hide debris very easily on the ocean floor. And you only can initially search with sonar. So you have to have something that reflects back to the sonar transmission. All of this makes it extremely difficult.
And in that case, and not only that, but it's remote, so it takes a long time to get to as right. well, which just exacerbates the problem.
Exactly. You know, everything about this, and now I'm glad that they're making considerations of an additional search. I hope that it comes through. I've been asked numerous times, you think we'll ever find it? And my answer is, if we're not searching, we're not going to find it.
Right.
So I'm glad that they're considering looking again. Ocean Infinity, if they say that they can further refine the data,
right.
Wonderful.
That private American company, right, that's been looking as well,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And if they, in fact, can refine the data, absolutely wonderful. I hope that they do it. I'd love to see this thing get found. I think we know what happened, but I think for the families that really want closure, finding the wreckage will provide that. Otherwise, there's going to be this open question of where's the wreckage? And I think I'm very hopeful that we'll find it.
Right. Do you get the impression that, I mean, I suppose with this, even if the calculations were just a little bit off, that could change the search area. So there's only two real options here, either where the Australians were looking or leading that search back and for several years, by the way, between 2014 and 2017, then Ocean Infinity looked further on until 2018. They're either not looking in the right place, which is conceivable, or they've missed it, which is seems less conceivable. But you mentioned just how treacherous that underwater terrain is.
I think that with the limitations of the technology, I think that they're pressing it about as hard as they can. Could they have missed it? Yes, it's possible. Is it more likely that they may have been in the close area but didn't pass one of the sonar devices directly over it, and then it wasn't enough to trigger an alert? I think that that is equal to or more likely. As far as I had an opportunity to speak with some of the people that were providing recommendations to the Australian Accident Investigation Board, and they're extremely knowledgeable. They're PhDs in Western Pacific ocean currents. And when you saw the bits and pieces of the wreckage show up on Reunion Island and other places, all of this fit, according to them, the area that was being searched. So they have not yet been successful, but all the evidence leads me to believe that they're in the right general vicinity.
Just this one piece of wreckage is not going to tell us what happened or why it happened. It's just going to confirm that, in fact, this airplane did go down in the water.
John Cox is with us. He is an aviation safety professional, CEO of Safety Operating Systems, a longtime aircraft accident investigator. We're talking about the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 10 years ago on March the 8th, 2014. It vanished on a flight between Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia and Beijing, with several hundred, with more than 200 people on board. Of course, the families continue to push for something to be done because there are still many questions that they believe need answered, and the wreckage would presumably help help do that. 12 crew members and 227 passengers, to be exact. John, I mean, anytime that something like this happens, there's been innumerable. I can't even count how many books have been written about this mystery and how many conspiracy theories are out there. But what we do know seems pretty clear, and you were just mentioning it. Debris from the plane did indeed wash up in Reunion Island, Mozambique, we believe. So somewhere far, far west of where this all happened.
The conspiracy theories, particularly in social media, abound. You can find conspiracy theories that say pretty much anything, up into including, oh, the aliens got it. So as an accident investigator, you have to just put all of that aside and say, okay, what evidence do we have? And it's limited. And take that evidence and then line it up in the most logical path. And that's what you pursue. There is no reason to believe that the Inmarsat data is flawed. And if so, it provides a continuous track up until the airplane runs out of fuel in the Southern Indian Ocean. All right, with that quality of data, a lot of the conspiracy theories evaporate. They say, okay, well, it went to Russia, it went here, it went there. No, it didn't. The Inmarsat data is definitive. That didn't happen. Oh, there was a fire. No, it probably was not, because it's inconsistent with every other fire event that we've had in aviation. So you one by one, you take these conspiracy theories on up to the point that they come up with, oh, well, the aliens must have got it right before it went into the ocean. And that's so far-fetched that it doesn't warrant serious consideration.
No.
So the conspiracy theorists are alive and well, in that, you know, we're still looking for Amelia Earhart's airplane. And so we will continue, I hope, to look for Malaysia 370.
In this case, what are some of the things that have stood out to you? I mean, obviously, the debris field was never spotted, at least not, I mean, in the initial search, there was no debris field. There was no, some of the things we would expect to be seen weren't there. Although it's interesting that with the Air France flight that went down in the Atlantic, they knew exactly where that was, and the debris field led them astray, and it took them years to find it. Presumably, even if they had all, with what little data they've had about where it went down, this again is a very difficult search for anyone, even with the right math. What about these pieces? What do you make of, I mean, as an aircraft investigator, what are the things that stood out to you? What are the missing pieces, do you think, here?
One of the things that I have never been able to come to terms with was the lack of a debris field.
Right.
We haven't seen much in the way of light floating material that's ever shown up anywhere. And that is highly unusual for an airliner accident in open ocean. That one has always bothered me. So the question of why and how the airplane managed to impact the water could have had some relevance to that. There are some pieces that have washed up on Reunion Island, I believe, that were from the inside interior of the aircraft, mm-hmm. which means it split open. So where's the rest of it? Why so few? And so those questions like that, I think, may always be there. I'm not sure we're going to get to 100% of the questions being answered. And when we say, okay, if we can find the body of the wreckage, and at that point, at least we will be able to answer most of the questions. But until then, we can only answer the questions we can with the evidence at hand.
Right. And even at this stage, if the wreckage were to be located, do you believe, I mean, as you would well know, it could provide the answers to some of these many questions that we still have?
I think it'll definitely answer some. The biggest question is, if the voice recorders and the flight data recorder, after 10 years being immersed in the ocean, is anything recoverable from them? So that would be the very first thing. If we can find the recorders, I think we can definitively determine what happened. So that would be, you know, if there's one single thing that I would hope for, and I understand when I say this, that the families want all the wreckage as an accident investigator, I'd like the recorders because I want to know definitively what happened. But if we find the wreckage, the way that it's distributed, impact damage, all of those will add to the evidence, the circumstantial evidence around it, and will let us answer a few more of the questions.
The why, too, in this. I mean, I know there have been other investigations that have centered on pilots and so on. We obviously, the German Wings one comes to mind. But this one, even the search into the background of those who could have presumably done this, unless there's something we don't know about what was happening on board, and I don't want to indulge any of those conspiracy theories. But we've never really been able to answer the why particularly either, if you could possibly answer the why in a case like this.
When you look at the why, you have to look at who has knowledge, who has opportunity, and that narrows the field down significantly. They did background checks on all the passengers, and there are no 747 or 777 captains. There are no 777 pilots on board. There are no engineers from avionics manufacturers. There don't appear to be any but two people on the aircraft with in-depth knowledge of the systems, and particularly the flight management computer of the Boeing 777, and those are the two pilots, one of which, the first officer, was new to the airplane. I think he, as I remember, he was due to get married the following summer. Mm-hmm. He was on his normal career progression. So that
was
leaves
a training
now
flight. Yeah, it was his last training flight, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He had just upgraded to it. Very normal career progression for him. People that had flown with him and knew him were nothing but complimentary, very professional, a good pilot. And that leaves now the captain, who was very senior, was an instructor, who had had a long career with Malaysian Airlines, was an aviation enthusiast, had a simulator in his home, had worked with, you know, a lot of other people in aviation, was highly regarded. So that's when you start, you know, coming down to look at it, the captain had thousands of hours of experience in 777s. So he's clearly the most knowledgeable person on the airplane about how to disable the transponder and the ACAR system, because disabling the ACAR system was not a simple task, and it's not something that pilots would generally know. So it, now the focus increasingly ends up on the captain.
Right. And also, just and as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, just the route that he flew as well was a sophisticated route.
It would be highly unlikely that it would be coincidental that the turn would be right down the boundary between two countries, another turn right on the boundary between two countries, and then to go offshore exactly far enough to where the ground radar could no longer see the aircraft and then turn again. The likelihood of that being coincidental is remarkably low.
Of course, it can be found. It's a matter of time. You know, there have been ships lost that are found after hundreds of years. But whether it's in my lifetime, we cannot say. If we wait for that option, the only option is to, you know, have an active search based on whatever information that we get.
John Cox is with us this hour. We're talking about the crash or the disappearance of a Malaysia Flight 370 10 years ago this week on March the 8th, 2014. Here we are a decade later. We have a lot of the presumptions, but we still don't have the records. So there's a lot of answers left over. John, when you look at some of the reactions here, I mean, there's been a lot of accusations. I know there's a lot of anger, obviously, amongst the families. You know, a lot of the families have tried to pressure the Chinese government to do more, to put more pressure on the Malaysian government. Did you ever get the sense there was sort of foot dragging going on here? I mean, keep in mind, Malaysia Airlines had just had that horrific incident with MH17 in Ukraine. Then there was this one soon after. You know, this is owned ostensibly by the Malaysian government. Do you get the sense that there are regimes out there that don't really want the answers to that it's best to leave this mystery alone?
No, as a matter of fact, anytime you get governments attempting to cooperate and do complex tasks, it takes time. When you realize that the Chinese, the Malaysians, the Australians were all working together mm-hmm. and putting assets into the initial searches, it was remarkable. So I think that there was bureaucracy involved that slowed things down, as you would expect. But I talked to particularly the Australian investigators at some length, and I asked that question. I said, are you getting the help from Malaysia and from China that you need? And the answer was yes. So that gave me the feeling that yes, we may be hampered to some degree by bureaucracy, but that overall that the investigation was proceeding in an orderly and proper manner. So I don't think that anybody is trying to hide anything. I don't think the Malaysian government is trying to say, no, there are answers we don't want. I certainly don't think the Chinese are, because they had so many of their citizens on board. I think very much they would like to know what happened. The Malaysian government, I think, is sensitive to it, but all the information that I have heard is that they were cooperative in the effort.
When one looks at some of the language that's being used now, which is language that one is familiar with, have ever investigated, you know, cold cases, so to speak, as this may be in some senses, is that they need credible new evidence to continue a search. And I'm wondering what that credible new evidence might look like.
Probably it could come in a couple of different forms. One, if they found more physical evidence that said, okay, the ocean currents in this period of time suggest that a different search area, that would be one. That has not happened. Two, if there is a means to further refine the search area based on the Inmarsat data that and the confidence level of those new calculations is high enough, then that could be sufficient new evidence. But I think those are about the only two points at this juncture that we could hope for.
When you look at this, just to wrap up, when you look at this, I mean, this from your position, where do you, this must be quite the enigma, and always has been.
It is. Aviation does not like mysteries. I mean, we spend millions upon millions of dollars to sort through and learn everything possible from a tragic accident. And in this case, we haven't been able to solve it. It's one of a very few that the aviation industry has not solved. And that doesn't sit well with me or any of the other investigators that I know. You don't want to be able to, when asked a question, go, I can't tell you, I don't know. That lack of the ability to solve it, that lack of the ability to learn from it, the lack of information and leaving these all these unanswered questions goes against everything that we do in accident investigation. So it's one that all of us would like to see solved.
Right. Optimistic at all that we may not reach 20 with as few answers as we did 10?
I'd like to see additional searches. I'd like to see additional work done with the Inmarsat data. And I'd like to see new technology evolve that could help pinpoint the wreckage. And as we go forward, all of those things will happen. Technology will certainly evolve. There will be people that will continue to work the math on the Inmarsat data and further refine it. And then the question is only who's going to pay for the search, because it's quite expensive just to get a research vessel in the proximity of where the airplane impacted the water. So there's going to have to be a political determination made that, yep, somebody's going to finance it. That may be the constraining factor.
John, as always, I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
We used to listen to a lot of Bob Marley around my house when I was growing up. I think my parents even went to see him in Montreal back in the late 70s before he passed in 1981, obviously, and spoke very fondly of it. And I was always a big reggae fan, even when I was a kid. But Bob Marley was interesting to see because I remember seeing the preview for One Love, the Bob Marley biopic that came out earlier this year, and wondering how it would resonate so many years later. I mean, he passed away more than 40 years ago. Now, I know he continues to sell records and he has a huge place in the public imagination worldwide, as a matter of fact. Bob Marley's amazing. You'll hear Bob Marley everywhere. I mean, I've been in many places and you can hear Bob Marley in Bangkok. You can hear Bob Marley on the beach in Mexico. I mean, his music has sort of somehow become a universal soundtrack, right? You'll hear Bob Marley in many, many spots. But I was wondering who would have an appetite to go watch a Bob Marley biopic in 2024, right? Well, it turns out lots of people, because it's been maybe, I don't want to call it a sleeper success, but it's been a big success so far. It's nearing $150 million at the global box office, $146 million worldwide in under a month. And that's a lot of money. It charts Marley's life, of course. Marley's played by Kingsley Benadire from his rise to fame in the mid-70s up to his death in 1981. So it sort of charts that the most sort of prominent part of his career, because he'd had a music career for quite a while before that through the 60s and early 70s with the Wailers and so on. But this was really when he reached new heights in fame. The film is directed by Rinaldo Marcus Green, who co-wrote the screenplay with Terrence Winter, Frank Flowers, and Zach Balin. Here's just a taste of some of the movie.
Well, jamming. Hope you like jamming too.
Where you want to start?
From the beginning.
Reggae is a people music.
People coming together.
Ooh, yeah.
You know you're a superstar.
All right, we're jamming.
I'm a superstar.
I wanna jam it with you.
Going on.
We're jumping.
You can't separate the music and the message.
Because every day we pay the price.
And what is the message?
Sacrifice.
Peace.
Oh, life is worth much more than gold.
There you have it. One Love, the Bob Marley biopic, has done really, really well. Now, Marley may have helped bring reggae to the masses then, now, and in between. But there was a time that he played what is now a legendary concert at Toronto's Massey Hall back in June of 1975. It was one of the very few stops that he made on that tour that included New York and LA and San Francisco, London. It was the first, it was his North American debut. But the genre was already well known in the city, thanks to a growing Jamaican diaspora. Reggae had arrived in Toronto quite a while before Bob Marley did. He, in fact, really liked his time in Toronto. He enjoyed it there. So he went back in May of 76, June of 78, November of 79. And it would add another relationship, another layer to the relationship between reggae, the Jamaican community in that city, and Toronto itself. Someone who's really looked into this time and the impact that it had and Canadian reggae music in general and what it meant is Jason Wilson. He's a musician and author. He's the author of King Alpha's Song in a Strange Land, The Roots and Routes of Canadian Reggae, which won the Ontario Historical Society Award for history book. The Joseph Brandt Award, I should call it, was presented to him back in 2021, 2022 for that book. And he joins me now. Jason, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is interesting with the release of One Love, because I think it's brought up a lot of interest in reggae period, which sort of comes and goes over time. And it's interesting to look back at the history that reggae had, especially with Bob Marley's infamous Massey Hall concert in 1975, just how influential Bob Marley was to reggae in Canada at a certain point in time.
Well, he certainly was. He was the gateway for so many people outside of the Jamaican diaspora, of course, to sort of engage in this music that to a lot of rock musicians of that vintage didn't understand entirely. You know, for a lot of people that I've spoken to who were, you know, at the Massey Hall show or later on at the Maple Leaf Garden show, it's like, why is the bass playing on the off? Why, what is going on? The drums playing on three, you know, it didn't make sense, but it certainly didn't stop them coming and delving further into that exotica of Jamaican reggae music. And Bob was, you know, remains the face of reggae music.
Yeah. You've seen the movie, I guess. I mean, as a biopic, it's interesting. The music's great. I mean, there are aspects of the story which it glosses over, which many biopics do, but it was a reminder of his incredible influence and the fact that people still talk about him, you know, more than 40 years after his death.
Yeah. And I saw the movie last night, funny enough, and I was struck. I'd actually, you know, and I mean really struck. I had read all these sort of uncharitable reviews, and they were clanging around in my head as my wife and I, took our seats. But honestly, Ben, when the movie started and Kingsley Benadire was so believable and the patois was impeccable and I was carried away, and it kind of reminded me of what it was all about. Yes, of course, it was distilled and it could only ever be an essence of the entire story, but it was a beautiful essence in my mind. And I don't know, I have to go against the critics in this one. I'm maybe biased, I suppose, but I absolutely thought it was a brilliant movie.
What struck me about it was it's just the music, right? And then that was the essence of Bob Marley, right? I mean, you can get away from the family dramas and even the politics, and there was so much to the music and the message.
Absolutely, and funny you say that, because that first I call it the preamble, the 15 minutes or so before we actually hear a song. Mm-hmm. I was sort of melting into this. Okay, this is kind of cool. You know, they're doing this. They're talking about the politics a little bit, and it's interesting. And then when Benadire turns around as Bob, obviously, and calls the Wailers for let's do war, at the Smile concert. I absolutely teared up. I was like, when that music hit, when that down. Bam, bam. I was like, wow. I was overwhelmed. And I thought they did that wonderfully.
They did. I remember my dad had a 45 of Smile Jamaica, for the Jamaican pressing of one way back in the day that we used to play.
Wow.
At home. Yeah. I mean, it was those records were, I mean, the whole music scene in Jamaica has always been fascinating, but it had a huge, I mean, there was a pretty significant Jamaica diaspora in Toronto by the 60s and so on. And and we always talk about London and England and reggae. We don't as often talk about Toronto and the huge impact that reggae music and the Jamaican diaspora had on Canada, but certainly on Toronto in the 60s into the 70s. And it's interesting to think of Bob Marley in that context.
100%. I mean, that's kind of central to part of my thesis, at least in the King Alpha book, is that we look at the list of A-list Jamaican musicians that called Toronto home or had a Toronto address at one time or another, and it is staggering, and it absolutely is comparable to London. You know, we're talking about Leroy Sibbles and Jackie Mattu, who was very close to me and took me under his wing in the last couple of years of his life. But you can add Stranger Cole, Johnny Osborne, Delroy Wilson, Prince Jammy, Carlene Davis, Lord Tanimo, Alton Ellis. They all lived in Toronto, you know, and we're talking about pioneers and tastemakers of of Jamaican popular music from, as you said, the late 60s through to the 70s through to the 80s. And Toronto was a launch pad for some of them. Toronto was an escape for others. The difference, I suppose, between the London / UK experiment versus the Toronto one was that the UK had an infrastructure musically that allowed indigenous British reggae to sort of blossom more than Canadian reggae got its due. And so you have UB40 and Steel Pulse and Aswad becoming internationally renowned. And where we struggled, we had the Satellites and we had Messenger, of course, some very important bands, but didn't achieve the same level of international success that, those other British reggae bands. And of course, it all comes back to Bob. It absolutely all comes. I mean, I'll declare my bias with UB40 is that it's family for me. My cousin was in the band for 40 years.
Oh, wow.
But you know, they don't really start unless Ali Campbell and my other cousin Bernadette Virtue go on a date to the Lyceum to see Bob play, and it changes Ali's life. And so they start UB40 a few months after that. Like, that's one of many, many stories, and that's this incredible impact that he had there, and he certainly had the same kind of impact over here.
Amazing to think that in many ways UB40 was the first reggae a lot of people heard post Bob Marley, in some ways that they carried on that tradition. And the fact that Britain had a really vibrant, they sort of created Lover's Rock, if you want to call it that,
absolutely,
which is sort of a more British soul version of reggae that Bob was actually quite influenced by when he wound up living in London full time. When in Toronto itself, though, I guess it took a long time. I think one thing that's mentioned is that the Junos didn't recognize best reggae recording until the mid-80s. That it took a long time for Canada as a whole, and Toronto specifically, which is interesting considering it was happening right in the den of sort of Canadian music, the Canadian music business, that it took us so long to recognize what was happening, you know, just up the road on Eglinton, right?
Yeah, I think... Yeah, there's many reasons. One was, I've spoken with record CEOs that I was probably trying to hound down to to listen to my own music back in the day, who have since sort of confided in me that they just didn't know how to market this thing. You know, they got very close with Messenger and WEA, of course, signed them, and then Messenger had a deal with Roots Canada. So there was this sort of overlap, and that worked for a little while. And the Satellites became sort of Canada's UB40 because you got the multiracial thing, the non-Jamaicans in the band as well. But it never had that push, partly because of the size of the Canadian music industry. I mean, it's quite small. And we have to remember that, you know, even our big ones back in the day, your Anne Murray and Rush and Leonard Cohen, I mean, and Joni Mitchell, they all went somewhere else. You know, they all had to go somewhere else to sort of break internationally. And we just didn't have those champions of reggae that Britain did, like, you know, Paul McCartney, Keith Richards, the Stranglers, the Pretenders. They all, you know, quote unquote, adopted reggae bands and, you know, brought them on tour and helped them release, you know, Paul McCartney gets the Cimarrons recording their first album. We just didn't have that. We had, you know, people that kind of helped, like a Bruce Colburn that does Wondering Where the Lions Are, using Toronto reggae musicians and that. Mm-hmm. But we just didn't have that same infrastructure that Britain had at its disposal.
Jason Wilson is with us this half hour, musician and author. His book is called King Alpha's Song in a Strange Land, The Roots and Routes of Canadian Reggae. We're talking about One Love, the Bob Marley biopic, of course, because so much of what of the influence around reggae, how people came to discover reggae in this country, was thanks to Bob Marley. But Toronto already had a pretty vibrant scene by the time Bob Marley's albums were selling big. And Jason, he turns up at Massey Hall in 1975. And I was looking at the tour list for that tour particularly. There aren't many dates. I think it was New York, a couple, San Francisco, LA, back to England, and Toronto. And I would have thought what a big deal it would have been to not only the Jamaican community in Toronto at the time, but all those who had come to espouse this kind of new and exotic music form that we called reggae.
Yes. And keeping in mind, he had been before, but to a much smaller venue. So Massey Hall is, you know, we're talking a room in Canada, one of the top places you can end up as a musician. And you're absolutely right. Here it was, the king of reggae, coming to Toronto, and you have a very sizable Jamaican diaspora at this time. Not as big as it will be in about 5 years, but in 1975, it's still pretty astounding the number of expats that are living in the GTA at that time. And you know, it's funny if you look at, it's kind of cringeworthy, some of the press that tour got in Toronto, and even later on, when he plays Maple Leaf Gardens in 1979, the press is also a little cringy that some people probably don't want that are still around, and they probably don't want those interviews out there, but they're out there. So you have the Globe and Mail doing a kind of interesting outsider sort of here. You know, here's this dreadlocked, pot smoking, you know, rebel from Jamaica that clearly has won over a large swath of white Torontonians as well. He calls them freaks in his article.
Really?
Barefoot, bare feet, long hair, full beard, and blue jeans. The standard appearance for any middle class freak kid. That's the actual quote.
Wow.
So now I feel like it's a reasonably positive article, because you know he goes on to say how it went over very well and the crowd was very appreciative. But I'll note with interest that the Globe and Mail in that same edition has an essay on the terrifying Rastafarians of New York City, and that they're all time bombs waiting to explode. And it's just this, you know, as I said, the sect uses marijuana as an aphrodisiac. That was one of the lines. So, you know, basically they're anarchists. And this is in the same edition, remember, of the Bob Marley review from Massey Hall. So thankfully we've come a ways from then. But that was what, you know, that kind of oppositional music was up against. And either you were hip or you weren't.
Yeah, 45 years ago only. I mean, in our lifetimes, right?
That's right.
Or
absolutely.
You're in our lifetimes as well. It's interesting when one looks at, I mean, and you mentioned it as well, that, you know, here you had this diaspora coming to Canada, and we think of the Windrush generation, obviously, in Jamaica, but Canada had its own immigration from Jamaica as well. And how, I mean, it hasn't always been perfect, we know. I mean, race relations in Toronto haven't always been good. But in some ways, it was a bit of a door opening. The reggae became a meeting ground for this new community in Toronto and the existing Toronto community. And you mentioned that a lot of your thesis is about that as well.
That's, I mean, Ben, that is the heart of my whole raison d'etre, I guess, but certainly the book. You know, we like to pat ourselves on the back as Canadians and how wonderfully multicultural we are. But I sometimes wonder if we know what that takes to get to that. And I talk about, when I'm teaching as well, about this intercultural collision, because I do believe it's a collision. I'll change the names, but one of my favorite stories in the townhouses that I grew up at, Keel and Finch, was this family from out east in Canada, and this other family from Jamaica that had just arrived. And I have photographs when I'm in junior kindergarten in 1974, and then when I'm in grade five in 1980. And in this 1974, there was a handful of brown and black skinned people. But by 1980, I'm in the minority as a white person. And of course, kids don't think about these sorts of things, but it was stark. It was a stark sort of reminder. And I recall when this one Jamaican family, and we had about seven families in the townhouses from Jamaica at this point. But this one, they had an elder sort of teenager guy, and this family from out east had the exact same. So it was an absolute collision. They fought up and down our townhouse complex. And I remember standing at the door watching when I was, I must have been six or seven at the time, and my mom pulling me back, you know, in her Scottish accent, saying, come here, come away for the door. Yeah. But it was one of the best fights I ever saw. It was really fantastic. It was up and down. So I tell the students this story about this fight, and it was, you know, the family was involved, and actually the mother came out, and she was in it as well. And it was just, you know, a spectacle.
Jason, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.